What up? Welcome in. This is All Ball. All basketball, all ball, all the time. My guest in this episode is Tom Penders, legendary head coach at Texas, Houston, Columbia, Rhode Island, Tufts, right? Bridgeport Central, an old UConn basketball and baseball player. Wait till you hear what sport he actually played while coaching in college. While coaching in college, he was a national champion in another sport. Pretty amazing stuff that I had no idea before we started the conversation. I do want to hit you with this. Can we please take a breath on the, we need to stop college basketball because players are safer when they're at home. No, they're not. No, they're not. You know what you don't do when you're in college and you're at home? You don't go see a doctor or a trainer several times a week to get tested. Or if you're not feeling well. You're sick, you sweat it out at home, right? That's what you do. So in addition to not having the medical care, it's not like an 18 to 24-year-old, you send them home for a month, is not going to go out. So you have them under the supervision of your medical experts at school. You have them under the supervision of your coach so they can't go out. Plus, most college basketball players are used to this time of the year being alone on a campus anyway. It's the men's team, the women's team, and only the football team if they're playing in a bowl game. Otherwise, you got the campus to yourself. This is very normal. Are the games abnormal? Sure. Does it feel weird to be playing when so many things are shutting down? I'm sure it does. But you have to consider the alternative. And the alternative is either going home to take whatever you have home with you or to catch whatever is at home. And you're going to go out in public if you're home. Like, don't tell me these kids are going to go home and just stay inside the room and isolate and quarantine. Like, it's not happening. So I love the coaches that are thinking about everybody and what the best decision is. I would also point out that that's not actually the best decision. And by the way, it's weird. College basketball in Kentucky, kind of stinky. Duke, kind of average. Kansas, well-coached. Beat Creighton. Bill Self is going to go down as one of the more underrated coaches of all time, but that's not a super talented team. North Carolina, okay. Right, okay. Like, you almost feel like college basketball needs those teams or one or two of those teams to be awesome to grab America's attention. In the meantime, they're not. And we somehow have games, sometimes don't have games, didn't have Baylor Gonzaga. We're caught in the, should we be playing? Should we not be playing? Like, look, if you get to play, keep playing. If you can't, you shut down, you start back up, you get back after it. But I think the idea of sending kids home, that's not actually a safer, it's an interesting thought. Put it up as a brainstorming. All right, what are our options here, guys? What about sending him home? Not really a great idea. That's how I'd look at it. You can download the Doug Gottlieb Show on your iHeartRadio app. You can listen to the podcast version of it, or you can listen to it on Fox Sports Radio or foxsportsradio.com anytime. Before we get to Tom Penders, just want to remind you that's at 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific. He is a college basketball Hall of Famer. He has that kind of legendary curly hair. He is never short with his opinions. And you're going to love my sit down with soon to be inducted College Basketball Hall of Famer, Tom Penders. Obviously, he's a Hall of Famer. That's just one of the myriad of reasons we're having him on. Additionally, if you look over his left shoulder, if you're watching this on IG or on YouTube, he's also an author. He's been a college basketball analyst, college basketball head coach. He's Tom Penders. He joins us in the All Ball podcast. And let me start with this, Coach. I know you've known for a while. I know these classes were not just announced when it became, but where were you when you found out, and who was your first call to?
That's two questions. So I learned in early January of last year, right at the beginning of January, I got a call from the NABC that I was being inducted into the class of 2020 along with the other members. I didn't know who the other members were, and at that point I really didn't care. I was just elated. And are you sure? Who voted? How did I get in this thing? Because I really didn't have any idea, you know, how one gets elected to that. So they just said, no, it's your peers. You have to be recommended by a couple of people that are on or in the Hall of Fame. And then it goes to a committee. And then there's a secret society of coaches, ex-coaches that pick the candidates that go in. So the first one I called my daughter Carly, who's up in Rhode Island at our Rhode Island beach house. She's taking care of things up there, living up there during this pandemic. And we're here in Miami Beach. I'm recovering from back surgery, which I had in late August. Mm-hmm. And my surgeon was down here at the University of Miami. So we're here, and it's a nice place to rehab. I can think of worse places to be at this time.
Let's take me back, okay? Stratford, Connecticut is where you grew up, and you play basketball at UConn. And it's interesting, if you told people you played basketball at UConn now, it's a very different image than what UConn basketball was then. What was it like when you arrived on campus in stores?
Well, I was a full baseball scholarship athlete. The coach that committed a scholarship to me was Hugh Greer, and he had a very weird thing happen. He died on a racquetball court in early February of my senior year in high school. And I was leading the state in scoring, and I had a lot of schools chasing me, but I always wanted to go to UConn. I used to listen to their games on radio as a kid growing up, I think from the time I was 10 years old. And my older brother was there as a baseball player. The baseball coach said, if you want to try out for basketball, you go ahead. I think he didn't think I could make the basketball team. But the coach who came in the springtime, Fred Schaebel is his name. He went on to fame and other things. He was an executive vice president of Comcast in Philadelphia. He's still alive. We're still in contact. He was the second guy I called after I found out. And anyway, I went to UConn, and I went out in the fall after our baseball workouts were finished around the 25th of September. And I played pickup with the guys in the gym, and we played games of half court 4-on-4. And I stepped right into it, and, you know, I felt that I was the best point guard out there. We were called playmakers in that era. The point guard term didn't come until the early 70s. And it came from a coach who's also in the Hall of Fame, Hugh Durham. He had two little guys running that position, and he called one the point. They ran a 1-3-1 offense, and then he hit the wings, and you know, then he designated the 4 and the 5 in other ways, but that's where that term came from. So I was thinking to myself, going into my freshman year, that I could not only make the varsity, but I could play. And that's exactly what happened. The team in my freshman year, they finished like 16-11. They weren't very good. In our scrimmages we used to have, we were quicker, we were deeper. And, you know, like 5 guys from that team were in the rotation in my sophomore year. But we were basically an undefeated team that year. Our only 2 losses came when we didn't have our All-American center, Toby Kimball, who was out. He averaged 20 points and 21 rebounds a game. And he played about 11 years in the NBA as backup for Bill Russell, Kareem Abdul-Jabbar, and then a couple of other well-known centers in the league. He ended up out in San Diego with the San Diego Rockets. I remember going out there when I was in the Final Four and watching him play. And I checked him out when they were playing in Boston when I was at UConn. He was out. They thought he had some heart problem. It just was a chest muscle spasm. We were in Buffalo in the tournament, but we lost to Holy Cross, which was a big rival in those days. We played them twice a year, and they should have been in the conference with us, but they chose to be independent along with Providence and Boston College and go for the ECAC bids in those days. You know, it was very different than today. It was a regional sport. We were one of the few teams that had trips. We went to Texas and played Baylor. and SMU during my junior year. In my sophomore year, we traveled to that tournament in Buffalo where we lost Toby Kimball. And it was a, you know, a real competitive. The gyms were packed. UConn basketball was, you know, as big in the state of Connecticut as it is now. You know, there were like 14 state newspapers that covered us. And it wasn't unusual to have seven or eight of them show up for practice. And our coach was one of those who, you know, he's very organized and he, you know, he had his rules about talking to the media, but he allowed us, you know, like once a week to spend time with the media. So I got used to doing that as a sophomore. But, you know, it was an opportunity that I'm so glad I had. I had opportunities to sign baseball contracts. I was offered a lot of money out of high school, but I wanted to go to UConn, play baseball and basketball. In those days, you couldn't be a pro baseball player and play college basketball. So that was out. The draft started in my sophomore year in 1965, and we were in Omaha, Nebraska, playing in the College World Series. And a bunch of scouts were hounding me about would I sign if I was drafted. And I said, no, absolutely not. You know, I want to play basketball. I was the leader of the team already, and I enjoyed it so much. And UConn, if you're on the basketball team, if you're a starter on the basketball team, or, you know, in the rotation, you not only get fame, but you get attention. And when I finished playing ball at UConn, I played pro baseball for 1 year. And during the off season, I was offered a head high school job. And I loved the experience. I had a team of, we were called the Mighty Midgets. We came from a 4-win season with the same kids. And we turned it around and won 14 games and lost 6 and got to the state quarterfinals. So I was hooked. I turned down Cleveland's offer to come back. I made the all-star team as a first-year player. I was elevated to AA and was going to go back to AA. And we negotiated all the way through the spring and half the summer. But I decided to make my career in college basketball, or high school at that time. I really wasn't thinking about college basketball. I just loved coaching and teaching.
Okay, so you coached at two high schools. The second one was Bridgeport Central, which, by the way, is my mom grew up right down the street. I think she attended a leadership camp or something with you when you guys were both in high school. She was in Bridgeport, yes. You were in Stratford, right? How did you make the jump from Bridgeport Central to Tufts?
Well, our a guy who covered our team at UConn for the Willimantic paper, which is right next to Storrs, Connecticut, a guy named Dave Estridge, he moved up to Boston and became the sports writer for the Medford Daily newspaper, which is where Tufts is located, which is just like 5 miles from Boston Garden and a beautiful campus. But Dave called me up. He was the sports information director at Tufts while he was writing up there for a small paper in Medford. He just called me out of the blue in the late spring of 1969, 70, had to have been 71. Nobody's ever asked me that question. But it was after my third year at Central, and we were like the number one team in New England. We averaged over 100 points a game, and the state of Connecticut had just great basketball in that era. You know, Calvin Murphy played there, John Bagley, Wes Matthews, Charles Smith. They all came from the Bridgeport area, but Hartford and New Haven also put out excellent basketball teams and players during that time. And I was a little bit hesitant about making the move, but he just said, Tom, I've talked to the AD, I've talked to the assistant AD, I've talked to somebody in the faculty council, and the job is yours, that you got to come up here for an interview. So I said, what the heck? I went up there for an interview. I spent like 5 hours up there on campus, and I had the job. So I said, what? You know, I think I lost a few thousand dollars by going to Tufts, but it was a college job. They didn't tell me I had to coach another sport. So I chose, they gave me a choice between baseball, where I played professionally, and soccer, which I had never played in my life. But it was in the fall before basketball started, because, you know, you got to recruit in the spring in basketball. And I knew that. And I also knew that I'd be exhausted at the end of the season, like I always was, even in high school coaching. So I was a soccer, JV soccer coach. And our very first match was against Harvard, over at Harvard, next to the football stadium where they played a varsity game that day. And I coached against a guy named Seamus Mallon, who was the voice of American soccer for years here. He did the Olympics, the World Games. And he asked me after the game, it was a 1-1 tie, you know, Tom, what style of soccer was that? And I said, that's the way we play it in Bridgeport, Connecticut. And he looked at me kind of funny. He said, like, where's that? What does that have to do with soccer? But anyway, we full court.
It's like, so I don't know if you know that. So my dad's first college job was at Quinnipiac.
No
for Bert Kahn.
Hamden. Right?
Yes. Mm-hmm. And kind of same thing where Bert hired him to be the JV at the JV coach, varsity assistant, freshman coach as well. And he had to coach soccer. And he had no idea. So he went to the library, checked out a book on how to coach soccer. He had to line the fields. He didn't know how to line the fields at all, right? And that's very, very, very different time.
I knew your dad. He never told me that one.
You had incredible success at Tufts in a short period of time. How did you do it? Like, we think of these turnarounds nowadays, and it takes time. Why was it so easy for you, or at least seemingly so easy? You transitioned to a college game, and then, you know, you guys were very successful at Tufts. How did you do it?
Well, it was the wild 70s, the 1970s, you know, make this time of our lives look like a very calm time compared to the 1970s. You know, the 1968, the Vietnam War was still going on strong. Nixon was our president. Everybody was protesting. Everybody was demonstrating. And that is what happened to the coach before me, Doug. He allowed his players to go and protest here and protest there. And then basically, the black players just quit on him. And I was not only hired to build a program, but, you know, to correct what was going on within the basketball program and even the athletic department at that time. And that, you know, it was easy to me because I did that at the high school level. You know, first you have to build a team. You know, everybody talks about culture. That word was never used during my time, but, you know, I learned how to do that. And, you know, I had some really good mentors. And at that time, I was very close to Red Auerbach because he drafted Toby Kimball, and I got to know him when Toby was playing for the Celtics. And also, when I moved to Boston, the first thing I did, the first practices when they opened, is I called somebody in the Celtics front office and asked them if I could go and where was it. And the guy basically picked me up on campus and brought me to the site. It was in an area of Boston I would never be able to find. It's the most difficult city in the country to find your way around, Boston. It's ridiculously hard. It took me 3 years to figure it out, and then I was on my way to New York. But, I had there were some players there. There was a kid named Dennis Mink from Hartford Weaver, who I coached against in the tournament in Connecticut, in the state tournament, and they knocked us out. We split a game. It was one of our only losses in my 2 years at Central. But Dennis was a 6'7" forward. He was recruited by some Division I schools, but he wanted to go the academic route. And it was another young man named Reggie Freeman. I mean, not Reggie Freeman, Reggie Graham. Reggie was another 6'7" forward that was being recruited by UConn, Boston College, and NYU. Lou Rossini was their coach. And he decided to go the academic route in those days. He was advised by people in his high school. You know, he was a real smart kid. And he didn't even play basketball his freshman year. So that started it off. And then another incoming freshman was a guy named Eddie Tapscott, who ended up being the GM of the Knicks, the Wizards. And he was also executive vice president for the new Charlotte Bobcats under Bob Johnson. So I have two guys that were general managers that played for me that became NBA general managers, and Eddie's one. He also coached. When they fired Eddie Jordan, he became the bench coach for the rest of that year. And we're real close. He's a former captain of mine. He couldn't play during that first year. Dennis Mink couldn't play during that first year because freshmen could not play varsity basketball. So I knew I had them in my program, and then it was up to me to put a team together from the scraps left over from the year before, where they went 1-19. And, you know, it was a team with a lot of internal issues. But I, you know, I was able to straighten them out. I was able to get kids on the court who wanted to focus on basketball and not the president's office, and dedicate themselves to each other and what they were doing. And in our first year, we went 12-8. We were New England's most improved team. They didn't do nationally most improved in those days. And we were a college division team. We didn't have three divisions during those years at Tufts. They later became Division III. We didn't have basketball scholarships, but we had need scholarships like the Ivy League. And believe me, not that team, but in my second year, we were 22-4 and won the New England ECACs. We upset Jim Calhoun's Northeastern team. We were as good as most Division I schools, including UConn in that time, because UConn was really down in that period of time. So, you know, I just had better players as I was learning how to coach.
When you went to Columbia, one of the things that is, I do think that, and this year will be interesting with no Ivy League basketball, but we were close a couple years ago to getting into the discussion of where the Ivy League was, as I've been told, in the late 70s when you were there, where it was cool for high-level recruits on the East Coast to not only stay home, but to play for these unbelievable institutions, right? Is that a fair, right? Like, there was NBA-caliber players playing in the Ivy League in the 70s when you were at Columbia. Is that accurate?
Right. There wasn't much said about top 25. It was more like top 20. Well, during my years at Columbia, which is 4 years, there were always two Ivy League teams in the top 20. One was Penn and the other was Princeton. One year, Princeton would be stronger. They had some really outstanding ball clubs. And of course, Pete Carril was their coach. They played a little faster style. They were able to play speed up basketball if they had to. I remember going to a game when they beat Notre Dame by 20 points, and Notre Dame was like a top 10 team at that time. Notre Dame tried pressing them, and Princeton went right through their defense. But Penn had some really outstanding players, and they had this unknown coach named Chuck Daly. Nobody's ever heard of him before or since. And that's what I found myself coaching against in my first year at Columbia. The Ivy League was very good. And I had to recruit very well to get up to their level. And in my second year at Columbia, where I had a chance to recruit for a whole year, I was able to get four players from the West Coast, all from Northern California, the San Francisco, Oakland area. And they were outstanding players. And I sold to them, you know, go east. You know, you'll love New York. And San Francisco kids were not afraid of going to New York, where I could go to New Jersey and try to get the best players in New Jersey, and they'd laugh at me. You know, it was like trying to hand out subpoenas when you're going to an all-star game, you know, in the northern Jersey area. But I was able to recruit well. You have to recruit well. It took me in my third year there to win. I didn't do that in the first year because nobody did that in the Ivy League. You couldn't do it. You had to wait. Right. You had to wait for your class to come up. I didn't have a chance at the end of April, Doug, when they gave out the scholarships or the grants and the academic awards and all those things, when kids were deciding whether they would go to an Ivy or not. It was already decided, and I wasn't even allowed to bring a new applicant into the pool.
Sure.
So I had to accept what came. And in my second year, we had one junior and the rest 11 players were sophomores. And that was a really tough year, but that was the year we made our name because we had to play against Bob Knight and his great Indiana team that went undefeated in the Holiday Festival. And I got to do an article for Dick Schaap, who was the sports editor, who became a very dear friend of mine. He used to help me recruit. That was part of a kid's visit to go to lunch with Dick Schaap and walk That's around cool. the better spots of New York. And I sold New York. I couldn't sell it to local kids except for one player. And his name was Ricky Free. He was at Boys and Girls High School. He was the best player in the city, and he won the most valuable player at the only All-Star team that was played in the postseason. It was Pennsylvania against the U.S.
Dapper Dan, right?
Sonny Vaccaro's Dapper Dan tournament. And I wrote about it in my book about out-recruiting Joe B. Hall for Ricky Free. Ricky was the MVP, hands down. He got it. He got the award. And then after that game, Kentucky put the full court press on. Chuck Daly from Penn was recruiting him, but I went to every one of his high school games. And over at Boys and Girls High School, they didn't allow fans. I mean, not even parents could get in to watch their kids play. They were afternoon games because of violence after high school games.
Right.
But their coach, Frank Mickens, because I went to practices and got to know him, he said, just show up. The games are at 3. Show up at 2:30. I'll meet you in the back. Don't park your car in front of the school. It'll be gone in 15 minutes or you won't have any tires. Come around the back. We'll lock your car in the back. So anyway, I went to every one of his games and got a commitment out of him. And
that was my
best recruiting story in my entire career.
I'll share my late father's, my favorite recruiting story he has is he takes over Jacksonville about the same times. This is maybe a little bit earlier. This is 1974 takes over.
That's when I went to Columbia.
Right. So he takes over, you know, he's a New Yorker and he had been at Creighton and under Eddie Sutton and at Kansas State under Jack Hartman. So when he gets the job, the president calls him in and says, now, coach, our previous staff had a little bit different grant and aid program.
Joe Williams. And, sorry.
Right. And it was Tate's Lock, wasn't it? I think it was Tate's Lock was the previous coach.
And then they had Joe Williams before that.
So. Yes. And they also had Artis Gilmore.
Yes. Yes. Seven-footer. They had 2 7-footers on that team.
So, and they'd gone to the Final Four. So he's brought in to clean it up. So the president calls him and says, listen, your top recruit is Ricky Coleman. My dad saw him playing the Dapper Dan game after he took the job. But he cannot bring his Cadillac to campus. That Cadillac was not purchased by Mr. and Mrs. Coleman. So my dad flies up to Detroit to meet the parents. And he says, you know, had a lovely evening. And at the end, he said, listen, this is not my call. And all I can tell you is you can't bring the Cadillac. You can keep the Cadillac. You just can't bring it to campus. No problem. So first day of school, everybody shows up. There's a team meeting in the locker room. And Ricky Coleman walks from his dorm to the team meeting. When he gets there, he realized that every other kid on the team has a Cadillac. And so he's like, you know, coach, can I? Yes, second semester. Anyway, so good. Then you fast forward to second semester and Ricky Coleman is flunking out of school. So at the time, I think there's 18 scholarships. My dad had like 17 kids on scholarship. And he takes his best manager and he says, look, I'm going to put you on scholarship, but here's the deal. You have to get up every morning, walk Ricky Coleman to class, pick him up after class, walk him back, talk to his next class, etc. If he is not in every class, you lose your scholarship. Otherwise, so at the end of that semester, Ricky Coleman goes from ineligible to on the dean's list. The manager flunked out. That's the downside. Who was on scholarship flunked out. So anyway, everybody. I want to go to Texas, and I'm not skipping over Rhode Island, which I know is very near and dear to your heart, because it is fascinating how you Fordham, right? So, so why go from Columbia to Fordham?
Well, I didn't have scholarships in the Ivy League and Columbia anyway. They were starting to make the financial aid package where every player, no matter how good he was going to have to pay a certain part or work to make. If he made $5,000 in the summer, he probably had to put $4,000 of that toward his degree. And I saw that as a red flag coming. That wasn't an Ivy League rule. That was at Columbia. It sure wasn't going on at Penn and Princeton. You know, Princeton went on to win the NIT in 76. And that's when the NIT was good, because only one ACC school played in the NCAAs. And it was, you know, really good basketball at that time, the NIT. So I went to Fordham because I saw the potential there. And they had a good reputation when I was growing up. They had a great player named Ed Conlon, who played for Philadelphia Warriors with Wilt Chamberlain. He was an outstanding player there. And we played Fordham when I was at UConn. And in three games, they beat us once. And they had Johnny Bock coaching, who went on to coach in the NBA as Phil Jackson's assistant. And the Warriors, he was there. I think Al Addles was the head coach. Johnny was an outstanding coach and a respected NBA coach. So I knew it could be done at Fordham, where you could win. But their team was not – it was going to need a – maybe I could win a few games – my first year, but I thought I could recruit the New York area. I was trying hard at Columbia. I had Ricky Free, and I got to know all the coaches in the Catholic League in New York, which was a real strong basketball league. Every coach in the country was trying to recruit there. So I thought I could do well with basketball scholarships. And we went over there, and we didn't win in our first couple of years. We didn't have a winning record, but in year three, we won 19 games, went to Dayton in the NIT, and lost a triple overtime game to a guy named Roosevelt Chapman. He was an All-American from Brooklyn. Roosevelt and Don Donaher was their coach there. It was one of the best basketball games I had ever been involved in as a coach. And Don Donaher said the same thing on the other side. So that was my first experience in the NIT in year three. And we went on to go four more times. One time I was in NBC when NBC was doing the NCAA, you know, Selection Sunday. I was in the studio with Bill McAtee all Sunday afternoon. And about six favorites got beat at the smaller level. So, you know, the automatic bid got in. And then the second place bid got in from maybe the Ohio Valley. We didn't have a national reputation at Fordham. We should have, because we played a national schedule. We played Notre Dame when they were number one. The same year, we went out and played UCLA. That was on our way to Hawaii, where everybody was fighting over who was going to play us. That was my first year, and I got my 100th win out there, my very first year at Fordham. And the kids were wondering why in the hell I was celebrating after we lost to Hawaii in the opening round. I was number 100. I didn't know if I'd ever see 200.
But take me to Texas, though, because everything you had done in your life had been East Coast. You traveled, you know, you'd play professional baseball elsewhere. You traveled as a coach, but to take on the Texas job, you show up 1988 in Austin, Texas. How did you get that job?
The only time I'd ever been in Texas was in 1972 when I was playing fast pitch softball. Our team won the national championship in where the Cowboys play
wait,
now.
Wait, you played fast pitch softball while coaching high school basketball?
College basketball.
You were coaching at Tufts at the time.
Yeah, I played major fast pitch softball, which is the highest level of amateur softball. And I refused to even consider a job when I was coaching, unless it was in the Northeast where I could play for the Raybestos Cardinals, our team. It later became the Franklin Cardinals, one a guy named George Franklin.
How did you do this?
How did you coach? Until I was 39.
Well, okay, but how? Like you only practiced late at night? Was it once a week? How do you stay sharp? What positions? I have so many more questions about this than about Fordham.
Doug, real quickly, we couldn't even watch the kids practice back in that era. Fast pitch softball started in late May and went through the summer and ended in the middle of September. We played 100 games. We played on Wednesday nights. We played on Friday nights, Saturday night, and Sunday afternoon. And we traveled the U.S. most of the time. So I did some recruiting while I was doing that. When I was at Columbia, we played everywhere, even Canada back then, because we were the U.S. champions. I loved it. You know, I was a baseball player. Fast pitch softball is baseball on steroids. 7-inning game, 1 run can be huge in a fast pitch game. And we had 4 of the best pitchers in the world. So, you know, it was in my hometown of Stratford, Connecticut, which is a sister city or brother city with Bridgeport. And I was probably closer to the Bridgeport City Hall than I was the Stratford City Hall growing up. But the Raybestos Cardinals and the Raybestos Braquettes on the women's side dominated fast pitch softball from 1969 to 1984 when I played. So I wouldn't consider a job in anywhere outside of New York, all the way from New York, maybe New Jersey, all the way up to New England while I was playing. And I was able to retire after, you know, about 15 years in the game. And I made that Hall of Fame in 2016. But the truth of that story, I was probably the 8th guy on our team that got into the Hall of Fame. We were such a dominant team that, you know, I got in probably because I was a key player on 3 championship teams, and I played on 5 national championship teams. So what? I wasn't afraid to go to Texas at all. And when I went to Rhode Island, we go to the Sweet 16 in my second year. I was, I guess, a hot coach in those days. And the only school that really was after me was Rutgers. They had been after me one other time when I was at Fordham. And they chose Craig Littlepage, and that was fine with me. I really didn't chase the job at all. But then it changed, and they started paying really big money. At Rhode Island, I was one of the lowest-paid coaches in the country. I was making $47,500 from the University of Rhode Island in 1986, 87, 88. They gave me like a $2,000 raise in our Sweet 16 year. And then all of a sudden, Rutgers is offering me like $300,000, which seemed like $3 million at the time in the late 80s. So I was all set to go to Rutgers. I was going to have a final interview with their athletic director at the Final Four in Kansas City. And then I got a call from Texas. And their assistant athletic director was the guy who made contact with me at the Saturday games. I just happened to be with some coaches. He knew who I was. He introduced himself. And then later on, I got a phone call from him. And then later, the athletic director, DeLoss Dodds, called. So it all happened so fast. And before the weekend was over, I was offered the Texas job for a lot more than Rutgers was talking. So it was a combination of it being a challenge, because Texas had no tradition in basketball. You had to go back to the 40s They had two pennants on the wall last time I was in the gym or in the arena. It said Final Four, 1943, and 47 was the Elite Eight, first Elite Eight. In 1943, only eight teams were chosen to play in the NCAA tournament.
Everybody was in the Elite Eight. No,
everybody wasn't even the bigger tournament. The NIT.
But you did show up and you inherited pretty good talent, right? That's like one of the things that's interesting about it. I think Bob Wetlich was the coach before you got there, but it wasn't a terrible team in terms of what. What Travis Mays was there, right? And Lance Blanks was there as well.
Lance and Joey Wright, who were the BMW, Blanks, Mays, and Wright, they became very famous, at least in Texas. Everybody had BMW shirts, and they were the triplets of our era. A great bunch of players, great kids. Well, Lance Blanks had transferred from Virginia. He sat out the year before I came there. Joey Wright was at Drake. He averaged about a half a point a game. Mo Iba was an assistant coach there, I believe. And Mo told him that he wasn't a Division I player. And Lance averaged like 2 minutes a game and scored 8 points during his 2 years of Virginia. You can look that stuff up. But after
I'm looking it up as we speak, by the way. Go ahead.
Yeah. After a week of practice, I sat Joey Wright down and Lance down, and I said, I don't care what you guys did at your previous schools. I said, you guys have a chance to be one of the best backcourts in the country along with Travis. I said, we'll go with three guards, two guards, whatever, and rotate you guys. But you're going to be the heart and soul of this team. And, you know, I know talent. And I just had to work with Joey and Lance on their range, on their shot. Learn how to use your legs and your shot.
And how did
hold
you do
the
that?
Follow through. Well, I played. I was a player. And as a young coach, I had to teach kids how to shoot. And after a while, you get pretty good at it. And that's the one thing I did as a UConn player. I could shoot. I was a very good foul shooter, and I was a very good shooter. My points were scored, you know, sometimes beyond what is the NBA arc. I was a long-distance shooter, and I would drive and kick to my teammates. And instead of a motion offense, it was me going around my defender, penetrating and hitting the open man or throwing short lobs to my big guy. And anyway, I learned how to teach it. I had a great high school coach. My father was an outstanding basketball player. He knew how to shoot. So I learned at a very young age the fundamentals of shooting. And I can spot kids. I can go and watch a guy shoot free throws for 10 minutes, and I can tell you what he has to improve on, what he's doing wrong. And even to this day, you know, I can watch a game and see the kid. I see the rotation on the ball. Watch his follow through. You know, is he set before he gets it? Is he already started his shooting motion before or just as he's catching the ball? Or does he wait, look for the basket, and then go through? He's lost all of his rhythm by that time. And sometimes that's the difference between being a great three-point shooter and being a 25% three-point shooter. And, you know, I've helped kids since I retired, from all over the country, improve their shooting. When I was in Texas last winter, I talked with Matt Coleman a lot about using his legs and not shooting jump shots from out, you know, long range in the fourth part of the game. You know, 4 minutes to go, your legs are dead, you're wide open, but you don't have the strength to get it up there. So
sure.
Anyway, these players didn't have reputations or the history of being that great. Travis Mays was a center of his high school team in Ocala, Florida. And his high school coach told me when he called me up, he said, you know, we had to use him at center. We full court pressed, and he's great at that no matter where you put him. And, you know, you're going to have to work with him a little bit. Well, he was an easy study, and he picked things up right away. He was one of those guys that every coach should have. You know, he was glued into everything you said. You know, right. He took it home, wrote notes, and then he come back the next day with a couple of questions. He was that way about everything. He was conscientious, the whole bit.
What was it like to coach your son?
That was tough. Probably a lot tougher on me than it was for him. You know, he's had opportunities to talk about it, and he just cracks a smile and a joke, you know. Dad should have played me more. You know, he knew I was the best player on the team, but Tommy knew what he was getting into. You know, we had great guards at Texas when he came. We had B.J. Tyler, who was a third-team All-American. You had Roderick Anderson, and Reggie Freeman was like a four-man on that team, and Terrence Renshaw, the all-time leading scorer, who wasn't a scorer. He was like 15 points a game in high school. You know, he got all the awards for, you know, his team won. But Terrence was a reluctant scorer. You know, I had to, you know, kick him in the rear end a few times to get him to shoot more. But Terrence was a great player, all-around player. Defensively, he's now at Creighton working with their guards. And I thought that was a great place for him to go. He's been around. He's jumped around. You know, he tried to work his way up as an assistant coach with hopes of someday maybe going back east and coaching in the Big East somewhere. So Creighton's a great spot for him.
I agree.
Tommy agreed to play there. And I told him, I said, Tom, do you realize who's in front of you? He said, yeah, but Dad, yeah. You know, I want to be part of winning. I want to be a part of the whole deal. And it was just great to be around him every day. I mean, that was a godsend for me. I loved it. And maybe I could have played him more, but I played him when it counted. He was always on the floor. He was a finisher, great foul shooter, great open three-point shooter. But he wasn't Terrence Renshaw or B.J. Tyler or Roderick Anderson. So he knew that.
Your teams, and obviously if people are watching on the video form, you can see the running horns. You guys used to really run, really push the basketball. And that was one of the things that freed some of these players up to have better college careers than even had high school careers, right? Is you were – and Southwest Conference did play fast, but everywhere you went, you played fast. What – if you were to give
schools,
some
– Only two schools in the Southwest Conference ran. That was Arkansas and Texas. The rest of them – were walking it up the floor, and on their weekly telecast on Saturday afternoon, all you heard were bouncing basketballs and squeaking sneakers, kind of what we have to watch today with no crowd and, you know, there's no noise like they had at the NBA.
Why do you think more coaches don't play fast?
Well, I agree with my mentor, Red Auerbach, and I asked him this question when I went to George Washington. That's where his home is.
Right.
And he just said he just thinks that coaches are paid too much money and they have to justify the half, you know, this $5 million a year. They have to stand up and act like they're calling every play, calling every possession. And, you know, the kids are locked in and they're not allowed any freedom. They're not allowed to do what they can do best in many cases. The exceptions are Gonzaga, Creighton, who I saw yesterday. Sometimes Kansas lets their guys go a little bit. You know, I watched North Carolina last night. Nobody's allowed to dribble. You know, you have to pass it and cut, pass it and cut. And bad teams can stay with a great team like that, great talent. You know, Roy Williams last year won 14 games. Doing the same thing, pass and cut, pass and cut. And probably two guys from that team will eventually play in the NBA. And now this team, you know, they're doing the same thing. These kids, they come out of high school, they're great players in high school, but, you know, they're thinking too much. They got a pass and they're looking for a guy to screen or cut. So, you know, I just think that's the case. I believe Red Auerbach is right. You know, coaches now, they're control freaks again. Back in the 90s, when we were playing up-tempo, you also had UNLV averaging 90-something points a game. You had Duke averaging 94 for 95 points a game. You had Loyola Marymount averaging 109 points a game. You know, we coaches of that era, we all came from that school where we got into coaching not for the money, and we thought of any money we got as bonus money. You know, sure. we got ears on our contract. Oh my God! You know, we were used to the handshake and the 3-page contract, basically 1 page for your signature, and now you have to have a lawyer, you know, and an accountant go in and speak to the people at the university. It's gotten so the ADs and the coaches are so separated at most of these schools now. And the AD is making maybe 1/10 of what a coach is making. And that doesn't make for a great job situation. Anytime you have people under
making more money, there's a disparity there.
The president's making $3 million and the basketball coach is making $9 million. I don't see how that doesn't lead to trouble and a good argument for paying the players. You know, where do I fit in here, coach? That's why they talk about it. It's because of the coaches' salaries. Now, I'm not trying to, you know, talk it down, but I think that's more reason for these coaches to let the kids go, you know, play. That was that era, late 80s and all the way up until almost 2000. Maybe a little over 2000. You had kids staying in school. I mean, Shaquille O'Neal, we played LSU for 3 years in a row. He was there all 3 years. He didn't leave until after his third year. Chris Jackson, who was on that team, All-American, high-scoring guard, he didn't leave until after his third year. And that was the case. Nobody left early. So it was the greatest era, the most talent ever in the game. And today's sport is still a good sport, because kids are getting opportunities and you got a lot more parity in the game. You've got great coaches. A lot more guys are really learning how to coach defense and switch defenses. And their scouting reports are exceptional. You know, my former manager, Chris Beard, is the head guy at Texas Tech. He was my manager for 4 years. And his last year, I asked him to do all the filming and we had a scholarship for him. And he said, yes, sir. And he wanted to be a coach. Yeah. So anyway, Chris has done pretty well for himself.
He's an amazing coach.
He's learned the communication and the team building stuff, I believe, from being around me. And then Bob Knight was the opposite in many ways, but he's a great defensive coach. And, you know, he knew how to run the motion offense, which I believe is obsolete today to a certain extent. But Chris has figured out a way to include ball screening, and he keeps good spacing, usually with guys, shooters in the corners, and all the action in the middle of the floor.
I got 2 minutes for you. 2 minutes for you. If somebody wanted to encapsulate your basketball philosophy and say, this is who Tom Penders was as a Hall of Fame basketball coach, former player, with this incredible path to success, what would it be?
Well, I think I was king of Mission Impossible. You know, in some cases, I was the only applicant for a job. You know, like Columbia, Fordham, even Tufts. Nobody wanted those jobs. Rhode Island, it opened up in September, and they came after me. I didn't know the job was even open. I was very happy at Fordham, but, you know, my wife cried when we left New York City to go up to Rhode Island. But, you know, a builder of good programs, but even more important, you know, I really believe is my relationships. I've got 7 families of college kids from 7 different universities, and every single one of them, you know, the guys who played for me, they stay in touch. And Dean Smith had that one family that everybody used to hear on every telecast. Yeah. I have 7 of them. And, you know, I expect a few of them to show up to my funeral, too.
If you could, if you change one thing about college basketball, would it be that guys would just let their guys play? Would it be paying their players? What would that last thing be?
I think move it to 24 seconds, just like the pros, and move the 3-point shot out a little bit. It's getting too easy. Can't go much deeper in the corners, but you know, move it out a little bit so there's more action, more driving. The middle's open, which you're seeing more of, which was the intention of the rule. But, you know, you have to keep tweaking basketball. If the kids are going to make it at the next level, you know, you have a right as a coach, you have a choice as a coach, rather, to help the kids along so they're used to playing NBA basketball and international basketball. They have a 24-second clock. I've coached it. I've had the privilege of coaching international ball. And, you know, the faster the game is, the more entertaining the game is. Nobody wants to see a 40 to 38 score.
Nope.
I mean, nobody, you know, nobody, I saw a score does. Yesterday, Tennessee and somebody, and it was like 48. I mean, come on.
To watch.
Yeah. Nope. Yeah. That's going to the dentist.
Well, listen, you're always entertaining. You're always welcome here. Let's do this again as the season goes on and just talk ball, not talk as much about you because your opinions are great on it. Yeah, but in the meantime, congratulations to you and your family and your seven basketball families in the College Basketball Hall of Fame. And thanks so much for joining us.
Thanks so much, Doug.
All right, the last thing here, with my thanks to Coach Penders for joining me for what was nearly an hour conversation. My last thing is this. I love this James Harden story, right? Like, the organization has done everything in their power to make it easier for him to win a championship. Now he's disgruntled over their ability to compete for a championship because they got rid of Russell Westbrook because they didn't seem to get along on the basketball floor, and he's mad. And even if you are mad, even if you do want to be traded, my advice to any professional athlete is show up to work and have those conversations in confidence, not filter it through your agent and, you know, and throw in these hissy fits. And I don't blame the Rockets for going like, yeah, we know you want to be traded. Doesn't matter. Play for us. Because he's an incredible talent. Incredible talent. Does he play defense? No. Does his style work in the postseason? Not really. And I think some of that is he doesn't play defense, and then the postseason he tries to play a little bit more defense, and he just doesn't have the energy for it to do what he does on offense. He dominates. That style is great in regular season, doesn't work in postseason. But that's not even the point. The bigger point is, why isn't he there? You got a new head coach, new general manager. The owner wasn't the one who acquired you or whatever. Like, just show up and put on the brave face and smile, and if you want to be traded, you can say as much. But that organization has done everything in their power to try and create a winner around you. It hasn't worked as of yet. And by my estimation, James Harden is as much the problem as any of the guys that they've jettisoned. And I think he's an incredible, spectacular talent. Not just scoring, but passing the basketball as well. All right, that's it for All Ball. Reminder to download or check out the Doug Gottlieb Show, 3 to 6 Eastern, 12 to 3 Pacific, FoxSportsRadio.com, Fox Sports Radio, iHeartRadio app. Thanks to Tom Penders, and thank you for listening. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this is All Ball.